1, 2, 3.
Today on Rockin' the Suburbs!
Okay, Patrick Foster's off for a few days, so you just have me, Jim Lenihan, here on Rockin' the Suburbs. But not just me, actually, because I'm taking a few days to talk with some old friends, and we're going to talk about music we grew up with. Yesterday, you heard me talk with a couple of high school friends about the early to mid-80s in Toledo, Ohio. And today, we're going to talk about the college years, my college years, so from 85 to 89 in Bloomington, Indiana, Indiana University, and for this special episode, I invited my very good friend, Tom Nord. Hey, Tom.
Hello.
What are you drinking there?
A discount Pinot Noir.
So it's good to be frugal, right? Especially with alcohol, because, well, I won't speak for you, but for me, that would be a big bill if I weren't frugal. I'll just say that. So,
oh yeah, that's part of the reason. I mean, I don't have $20 bottle budget.
Yeah. So, Tom, you and I went to school together at IU, and you live in Louisville now. And for quite some time, I lived in Louisville. So we have like two different, you know, periods of time where we were hanging out a lot. But let's focus this on IU. You started at Indiana in 86, your sophomore year?
Yeah, I joined the party in 86. I had started out at a satellite campus in 85. And if you'd ever like to do a show about the New Albany music scene, 1985,
yeah.
I was knee deep in that as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I came up to IU in my sophomore year.
Yes. And I remember this this is important, I think, because I'll just mention that in 85, when I started that fall, I went to see REM play at the IU Auditorium. Was that what it was called? The IU Auditorium?
And oh, it is.
Yeah. And that was the Fables tour.
And I too was at that show.
Oh, so you went to that show too?
My sister was at IU.
That's right.
And my brothers and I, who weren't there, and all four of the siblings who weren't there drove up to Bloomington to see the show, to join my sister. And she had this destructive, raging party at her house that night. And we still talk about it in the family. My little brother, who was like 16 and shouldn't have been there, he got so drunk. And I think people used to do that. They let 16-year-olds drink. He kept going to the door and locking it, even though it had been locked like 30 times. And he said, "No one's getting in here tonight." And we were like, "No one's trying to get in here tonight. I don't know what you're talking about." And plus, I think the lock might have been broken. So I don't know. I don't even know if that was even true, that no one was getting in here that night. But the after party for that show is almost as memorable to me as the show itself. So,
all right, this is good, because I felt that if we're talking about music from the college years, we should start with REM, because to me that was huge. And I think for you too, right? Like, how did you get into REM?
I was in high school like the same time as you. And I grew up not really listening to a lot of music. I was a nerd, and I didn't really pay attention. And I wasn't a record collector, and I just didn't know what was going on in music. And so I think my little brother, actually, who's actually became a musician, was the one that kind of got me into it. So it was like the little brother doing it to the big brother, which is very unusual. So he just got knee deep in music and he started buying vinyl and he started buying like all the 60s British stuff, like The Who and the Rolling Stones and the Kinks and everything. And then he got into Springsteen and that was like great. He had really good taste. And then one day it was like literally like, oh, this REM band, you know, because I wasn't really aware of alternative music. I just knew there was music. We had MTV and that helped because MTV started coming in. So I guess REM was on MTV, which is amazing to people to think about. And just coincidentally, he's like, he got like copies of the Bob and he had flexi discs and,
right.
And then of course they, you know, they were, I don't think people realize they were famous pretty early. Like Rolling Stone had them as like one of their best bands, you know, like in 1983. So it wasn't like they were like underground. They were probably less underground than even Nirvana. I mean, like they were formed in like 1980, but like 1983, the Rolling Stone had them. So it wasn't like we were dredging up something from the ocean. But so I was in high school and I started liking them, and it was weird. Like I was suddenly, I felt like I had something that the other kids didn't have. It's a classic story of you're just sort of moping around high school. You're not one of the cool kids. You're not really an outcast. You're not like completely in some other niche. You're just kind of getting by. And then suddenly this band comes along that helps kind of define you. It gave me like a personality. And suddenly there were all these other kids in the high school class that I knew kind of like, that was the thing that tied us all together. It's like, oh, you like REM, you like REM. And so, you know, I have lifelong friends who I kind of met because we, you know, REM and other bands as well. But, you know, it's that kind of story. So by the time they really started hitting it, you know, 85 was right. Then the tidal wave starts, you know.
Yeah, and then, so, right. I don't think it's overstating at all. And I'm so pleased that your experience is the same, that REM was like a life-changing band. It really was. It for me, you know, I grew up pretty much on Top 40 and, you know, AOR stations, you know, what was on the radio. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I had heard of REM, but I had never heard their music. And so, you know, when I get to college, it's like, well, I want to do the cool college things. I'm going to go see this band that's coming. And it was, and then I saw that I went and got Fables of Reconstruction in anticipation of that show and just listened to that. And I was just like, I opened up a whole new world from there. You know, it was like the gateway to all this other, you know, more interesting music, I think.
The next band that I got from REM was The Replacements, because Peter Buck worked on Let It Be. And so there you go. Like anything REM was doing, we were interested in. And so he made, you know, if Peter Buck, I mean, we would have discovered The Replacements anyway, but it was just very tidy that Peter Buck, and I still don't really understand how that happened. Like, I know there's probably books been written about it, but like, I don't know how Peter Buck and The Replacements ever got together, but they did. And then you get that was that. And then, you know, Husker Du comes from that and all these different bands come from that, you know.
That's right. The one I remember that you and your brother Andrew turned me on to was the Connells.
The Connells. Yeah, the Connells were a band. And I think there was, again, I think that had something to, Let's Active. Let's Active was a great band. again, connected. I know REM was like this big, maybe the sun that it all revolves around. Other people have different bands, and I'm sure if you looked at other bands, they'd say, oh, yeah, I know this band because of that. But REM really was, because Let's Active was a band we really loved. My sister, my late sister, loved Let's Active. She was, I should mention her, too. In addition to my brother, Andrew, my sister Molly, who was the one who had the party, she was a huge music fan, and she came into music from, whereas Andrew was more into like the Southern goth, alt, I guess pre-alt country, what you would call it, and the British stuff. My sister Molly was really into the Go-Go. She was into the LA punk stuff. She's into X. I should give her credit, because I mean, she did that too. And B-52s, all those bands like that. Yes. And Let's Active. Let's Active is one of those bands. I think she may have been into them before we were into REM. It's kind of a complicated story, but like, I loved Let's Active a lot. And then, of course, REM recorded one of their records, I think. I think Mitch Easter
produced the first two, right?
Yeah, because then by the third one, I think, was they went to England. And
yes.
Yeah that was, the dark, rainy record. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so Drive-In Studio, yeah. And then I guess, I don't know how, again, the Connells are from North Carolina. I don't know if they were connected to Mitch Easter at all, but I think anything in that region, people kind of dump on the South now. Like, I know the South is kind of polarizing, but growing up, the South was the hotbed of all the great music to us. I mean, any band from North Carolina or Georgia, I mean, we weren't not so much Alabama or Mississippi. The blues and stuff, but we
right.
like college bands from the South were so hot back then.
Yes.
I mean, the Replacements even have a song about it. I mean, like, you know, Left of the Dial is about, I guess, driving around Georgia, right? Listening right. to college radio.
Right. So that's right.
So the bands like that, there was a band called, Zeitgeist that I really liked out of Texas. They became the Reavers. I think we were just, you know, there's just a lot of stuff going on. And the weird thing was, you could kind of like, you had to work a little bit at it. And I think that made it kind of interesting. I'm not saying today I'm not criticizing people today for being able to just listen to anything they want anytime, but it was really cool, like discovering things.
So I want to ask you about the trip we took to Memphis. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
So we're in college. This would have been, I don't know. 88. Okay.
88.
And we just decide, like you and I and a group of other people, to on spring break to go down to Memphis, because that was a great like music town and we could do music stuff. And it was a great time, right?
Right. When the other kids were going to like Florida and having sex.
Yeah.
We thought it'd be really cool to rent a luxury van from Ugly Duckling Rent-A-Car.
That's right.
And also, I don't know when did that rule change? Because we were able to rent it because we were 21, but they've changed the law. Now you can't rent a car till like 25, which seems insane to me. But yeah, they just said, you kids look safe. So yeah, and we drove that van, and it had like carpet and like captain's chairs, and we filled it with, we bought like 12 cases of Strohs.
Yes.
And it was like packed in the aisles of the van.
Yes.
And yeah, it was, and we did Graceland, and we went to Sun Studios. Yep. And just went to Beale Street.
Yeah.
And we went to Nashville.
Yeah.
Hung around there for a day.
Yes.
I thought that was a good trip. I thought that was a great college trip. I think, you know, it would have been more fun maybe in the long scheme of things to go to the beach and have sex. But I think it was cool to go and do that. I think that was a great trip.
It was great fun. And in Nashville, we stayed in a hotel with a guitar-shaped pool.
We did.
What was that? We yes.
did. It was like, well, it was a base shaped pool, because for some reason we talked about this. They only painted four strings on the guitar.
That's right.
And I don't think that was the plan. I don't think they were like, oh, it's a base-shaped pool. Like, I don't think the guy around the hotel was like, oh, it's a base. No, I just think they didn't know how many guitars. I think Herbert the pool didn't know how many strings were on the guitar.
They were saving money on paint.
four stripes.
Nobody will notice.
And we also that this is not, I'm sure your listeners care about this, but like there was this, we were in the pool and there was like a bar or a restaurant like next to the pool. Mm-hmm. And we were such jerks.
Yes.
Like we were doing dumb shit. Like we were like running and jumping and catching beers as we fell into the pool.
Yes.
And making all kinds of noise. And I know that the people, it wasn't a nice hotel.
No.
But it was a nice enough hotel that the people having dinner were just not, I think, amused at the spectacle of this stuff going on at the pool. It was just noisy and loud. And I think back about like now whenever I'm like out somewhere and I see like annoying teenagers who listen to their loud music when I'm trying to sleep at like 11 o'clock at night, I think, you know, that was me.
Yeah. That's right. Pay it forward, or backward or something. Anyway, no, that trip was great fun, and I remember it coming shortly after. There were a few of us, you, Charlie, I think, and maybe somebody else, Avi, I'm not sure, who took that History of Rock and Roll course with Glenn Gass at IU. And to me, that was important because that really got me into like Elvis and made me understand, you know, the origins of rock music better and the threads and all of that. And so, you know, I was really on this like kick of like, yeah, I'll go to Memphis. I want to go see Sun Studio. I want to see Graceland, all that stuff. It was genuine. It was real fun. It wasn't just like, you know, screwing around and, you know, seeing it for like kitsch value.
I don't think, no, it wasn't. I don't think, I mean, again, this goes to this was pre-internet, and it's like until a few generations go by, it's important. We're going to have to explain to people that it's like before the internet, it was very, very easy to like just not be curious or have a narrative set. And I think that when we were in college in the late 80s, Elvis was a joke.
Right.
Elvis was a joke. I know that Grell Marcus had written Mystery Train, and the real cool people knew he wasn't a joke. But again, it's like it wasn't like it was necessarily easy to access that. So we were lucky because we were under the thrall of a great college professor who taught a class that everyone thought, you know, yeah, History of Rock and Roll, what a joke. And you know, it was a fairly, I mean, I got an A in it. You got an A in it. You could get an A in it. Although I think when I think back at it, it wasn't like an easy A. I don't think, we just got A's in it because we were like good at it. But he was trying to explain to us that this guy who's because in 1988, they were still running ads on TV for like crappy Elvis compilations, like Elvis Gospel and Elvis Hawaii. Like he was still a joke. And I think the family was still squeezing him for money. He still had living relatives then. I mean, the whole Elvis culture in the late 80s was still pretty like bad. And I think that we were fortunate enough to have someone tell us, like, we didn't need someone to tell us Buddy Holly was cool.
Right.
We didn't really need someone to tell us the Beatles were cool. Although he did, on a tangent, that professor did a good job of kind of explaining to us why the Beatles were cool, why the Beach Boys were cool. But Elvis was like a rehabilitation project. It was like, no, you got to go way back. And so I remember being obsessed with the song Mystery Train.
Yep.
That's All Right. I was obsessed with That's All Right. I think That's All Right Mama is one of the, because I talked about this with you years ago about how like you think about that song and that child man going into that studio and like apparently they didn't get it right the first time and they were like, we don't know, this isn't really our thing. And like Sam Phillips was like, this isn't gonna, you know, it's too gospely. And then he's like, wait. And they start playing, like, I don't know if it was Mystery Train or That's All Right. And it was like, That's what I want.
Yes, yes.
That was, and I still get stirred by that.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama. Any way you do. Well, Mama, she done told me. Papa done told me too. Son, that gal you foolin' with, she ain't no good for you. But that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama, anyway do.
And the great thing about that course was, like, how else would we be exposed to those early Sun Studio Elvis recordings? Like, you never heard right. that. You never heard that. You heard, you know, It's Now or Never. You heard, you know, that kind of stuff, right? And
I mean, it was clear that he was a cool guy. Yeah. And he was great. Yeah. He had these worship. I think the thing is, Elvis died, like, in our, I mean, I remember when Elvis died. I was a kid, but I remember. And there were, but yep. his fans were, like, worshipful in a sort of, like, he was so huge and he had gotten so big and so important to people, but he was important to people in the same way. I hate to say kind of like in the same way that Michael Jackson was important to people, like beyond just the music, he really, really gave people something that they were lacking in their lives, but mostly had been forgotten was the fact that there was this 30 years before there was this raw country boy who was walked into the studio and made this crazy, like, white guy singing black music. And
right.
By the time he went, because we all know the story, like, by the time he went in the army and made the movies, it was kind of over. But it was just really cool to, like, hey, this guy was really cool.
Yeah.
Like, Elvis was cool because he was Elvis. You know, even the jumpsuits and the
right.
the world travel and the movies. But to learn that, oh, no, he was, like, cool, like Kurt Cobain was cool, or Lou Reed was cool.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Patti Smith was cool, you know, like that kind of cool.
Yeah.
That raw, I don't have anything to lose cool.
Yeah, totally agree. Are there any shows you remember going to in Bloomington at, like, Second Story or Jake's or Bluebird or any of that? Like, is there anything stand out?
Well, they might be Giants came.
Oh, yeah, they might be Giants. Push the tables back.
You saw them. They were on the Lincoln tour.
Yes.
And you've told the story, but I'll tell it again. The Second Story was like an old, like a Oddfellows lodge.
Yes.
I mean, the stage wasn't even, it was just a riser.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like.
Right. It wasn't like a constructed stage. It was, yeah.
It was like 5 inches off the ground. It was just slightly higher than the audience.
Yes.
And they had tables and like they had sconces and they had like an oak bar. And people would just come in and like they had tables and like people would sit at tables. And I guess a dance floor would open up. And sometimes like the people who ran the place, I never met them, but like, I think they ever really understood what was going on. And so people would be sitting at these tables and like the people would be crowding up around the stage and the tables would just still be there. And John Flansburgh was noticing that people were sort of getting crowded between the tables and the stage. And at one point during one of the songs, he just starts putting into the song. Cause you know, they would do like, you know, he goes, push the tables back.
Yes. I still remember it to this day. It's
like just part of the song, like push the tables back.
Yes.
And I saw Firehose there.
Yep. Yep.
And Mike Watt.
Yep.
Was cool.
And the great thing about that was in both those cases with They Might Be Giants and with Firehose, like you, literally like the show would be over and you could just like walk like into their dressing room and say, hey, you know what I mean?
Packing it was up great. Stuff. Yeah. The Dead Milkmen,
mm-hmm.
They were cool because they were just like, they were just talking to us after the show. I remember after They Might Be Giants, Second Story, as the name implies, was on the second story of a bar. There's a bar downstairs, and like it's like a split level.
Yeah.
So there was nothing at street level, which is interesting. There was a basement bar and like a half, like a mezzanine bar.
Okay.
And so so you had these like the lobby or the door, you go down these steps. And I remember John Flansburgh stood in the lobby or the doorway for hours talking to us. Mm-hmm. Just talking to us about, like, he was telling us about this thing and that thing. And like, John Linnell's never been apparently very talkative.
Right.
I interviewed John Flansburgh years later, and I realized that that's just, he does all the talking.
Like, yeah.
John Linnell doesn't. He's like Penn and Teller. Yeah. You know, it's like, although, you know, Linnell does sing, he just doesn't really do a lot of talking.
Yeah, no, that's
his thing. The Connells came. We saw the Connells there. Back to them. They came, and I remember we'd seen the Connells a bunch of times, and we got to be kind of friends with the Connells. And there's no context for the audience. It's just the Connells is just this great band from North Carolina, very goth Southern band, poppy band.
Yeah.
But the lead singer Doug was like, got to be friends with us, and he was like really excited. He'd get really excited about things. And I remember they came, and he's like, "Hey, I'm really into Burt Bacharach." And so we're like, "Okay, tell us more." And he goes, "Come out to the van." And so we ran out to the van, and he had a bunch of Burt Bacharach 8-track tapes in like a plastic bag. He's like showing us these Burt Bacharach 8-track tapes. And he was in a band. No one's going to care about this, but like he was in a band that was like the April Fools, which was like a Burt Bacharach cover band.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, and I saw 10,000 Maniacs, which I was really eaten up by. 10,000 Maniacs came to Bloomington. They opened for REM on the Live Search Pageant Tour. No, they opened up on
Fables.
The,
it was Fables.
Fables Tour.
It was the first one I went to. The second one, which I have the poster here, was Fetchin' Bones.
Fetchin' Bones. They were cool too. I don't know what happened to them. Yeah. I loved 10,000 Maniacs. I loved Natalie Merchant. I was just so enamored by her. So I was like, when they came to the Connells opened for them, 10,000 Maniacs at this club called Jake's, which is like another club. And I got to go backstage, and Natalie Merchant was like, she had this like Kroger. They'd given her like the green room. It was like this Kroger vegetable tray, because I guess she's a vegetarian. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, "Oh, okay, here's some vegetables for you." And she said, "Would you like a carrot stick?"
Yes.
And I said, "I do. I do indeed. Well, I ate a little carrot stick."
Yeah.
Even though at that time in my life, that was the most disgusting thing I could think of.
Carrot stick. No, I remember you now were excited about that. I remember you saying, coming back and reporting that you shared a deli.
Yes.
You shared a vegetable tray with Natalie Merchant.
We I think I said crudité.
Yeah.
I think I said it.
We were all very impressed by that.
Yes. She was so sweet, and she was tiny. She was nice.
So
I thought we might start dating or something, but it didn't happen.
So one last thing I want to talk about is there was a local band that we really enjoyed and became friends with, and they were quite colorful, and that was the Toenails.
The Toenails, yes.
What were the Toenails like? Can you describe them?
I think the Toenails were ahead of their time.
Yes.
I thought they were fantastic. I think that it was a guitar and drums, and I think we were conditioned to believe that, you know, there's got to be a bass, there's maybe a keyboard, but they were just like, no, just a guy with a drum and a guy with a bass, or a guy with a guitar.
Yeah.
And they were just like, and they had a stupid name. It was just a terrible name. And I think that I've actually befriended people in bands like that. Sometimes people in bands are so smart, they're almost too smart, and they almost, the joke is beyond what the fans understand. And like it was T-O-N-E.
Tone. like music ale. Tone ales like beer ales. Ales. Yes, it was but like it was an O'Neaters kind of thing.
It was like an O'Neaters, except all you see is like, oh, tone ales. What a bunch of gross, like Beavis and Butthead. Yeah, it's gross. Like they didn't take themselves seriously, but they were very good. And so, because I think that if you have a guitar and a drum, you have to be better. It's like, kind of like the Jack White thing. When Jack White was at his sort of early peak, you know, and nothing gets Meg was better drummer than she gets credit. But like, you got to work a lot harder when it's just you and a drummer.
Yeah.
You're doing everything. Like you're doing your rhythm. You're doing your beat. You're doing everything together. And like, so they were like that. So when the White Stripes came along, like literally 15, 20 years later, or do you remember the Flat Duo Jets out of Georgia?
Yeah,
similar, kind of at the same time. And I'm sure if you go around again, it's kind of like who invented the cheeseburger? It's like, well, I'm sure everybody was inventing the cheeseburger at the same point. But like, I'm sure there were like bands like the Toenails or the Flat Duo Jets everywhere. But I was just fascinated by that because the weird thing is like when you have two people, you would think that it's like the energy of two guys, two gals, a guy and a gal hitting it so hard on two instruments. It's just infectious. It wasn't like punk rock. Like they weren't like that. It was more just like the driving energy of like a really good like blues rock band.
Just
two guys. And they were crazy. They were insane. And they did a cover. The Toenails did a cover of Stop Dragging My Heart Around. Was that the Tom Petty?
Yeah.
Where the drummer would sing the Stevie Nicks part and the guitar player would sing the Tom Petty part. And it's like, I loved it, but it's like, this is just an abomination. This is just terrible.
Well, the thing I loved was that they would take on, they were two guys, as you said, and they would take on really ambitious covers, like covers that just like four people would have trouble doing. And they'd do like Knights in White Satin and stuff like that. It was amazing.
They organized a Tommy tribute.
Yeah.
Where they got a bunch of local musicians to do like the entire Tommy album. And they got, you know, all the local deadbeats to get involved.
One last thing I want to say about the Toenails too, is they did play original songs, and I don't remember.
They did.
The only one I can remember was one called Get Into the Pudding. That's all I know. So, yeah.
You know, I probably didn't understand that was a sexual reference.
I don't know. Didn't matter.
So, just to cover the waterfront here. Yes. So we left college in 89.
Yeah.
The end of 89. It's very tidy, like right at the beginning of the 90s.
Right.
It's funny, like by the time we were out of college, like that first year out of college, all that stuff that we had sort of been into and proud of and felt was awesome finally broke out to everything. And I think that I don't know, is there a parallel to, you know, when punk broke, when psychedelia broke? I mean, there was always somebody who was into it before, and then everybody's into it. I never resented it. I always thought it was like kind of cool, you know.
Yeah.
But I just think about like how, you know, when bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam and any number of bands, like a lot of bands benefited. And I know people are very sour about what Nirvana did to the music business and whatever. You can argue about that all you want. Again, that weird window between the record industry powerful and the internet like democratizing everything. But it's like, it's funny to think back about 1988, 89 and not having any idea that was coming.
Right.
It's like, we had no idea. Like, it's just kind of interesting. Like, we didn't know it was coming. We had no idea that any of this stuff was going to happen.
No, not at all. Okay. We got to wrap it up. Thanks very much, Tom. Thanks for hanging out.
Do you want to say one thing about the Replacement show?
That we saw the Replacements on the Pleased to Meet Me tour in the, what was that thing called? That was in the Student Union.
It's called Alumni Hall.
Alumni Hall is what it was called? Okay. Yeah. So what do you remember from that?
Just how bad it was.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was, that's how I remember
it was like, I was really excited about it. You kind of gave us some warning because I think you interviewed Paul.
I did. I interviewed him backstage before the show and he drank a lot.
Well, I feel like you
and
told
I got to
us
see
like,
their sound check too, which was actually
I think
good.
But the show, you kind of were like saying, you know, he's really drunk.
Yeah. Yeah.
You described it as like bottles and beer cans. And I'm like, okay, well, that's fine. I only paid like $8 for this, you know, it's like whatever. And, but it was bad. It was bad. And he got hostile and argumentative and the sound was terrible. And, it really disappointed me because I love them so much. My brother and I love the Replacements and everything they did was like, they could do no wrong. And I guess we were like, we were alcoholics too. So it's not like we were judging them, but it's like, God, you could at least stop drinking long enough to do a show. Like we had this unwritten rule at the newspaper we worked at that, like, you don't drink before 10 a.m. you know, like,
that's the unwritten rule.
Yeah. Just something like going, because the paper's got to come out. And so it's like, just don't get so drunk that the yeah. paper didn't come out, you know, Point of Pride always came out and, you know, hashtag heroes,
yeah.
But, yeah, it was bad. It was bad. It was very disappointing. But the redemption arc is that like 3 years later, I saw him up in Chicago, went up, you were there at the Cabaret Metro or whatever that place was called.
Mm-hmm. They played at the,
Aragon Ballroom.
That's it. Aragon Ballroom. Yep.
Yeah. And he was like,
that was great.
Brilliant.
It was great. Yeah. And that was the thing. I think I saw them all told six times. Well, if you count the reunion stuff, so let's not count that, but I think I saw them four times before that. Yeah. But I'm just saying back when they were back in their, you know, prime, so to speak, I think I saw them four times. I think there were two good and two bad shows. So it was like always like a 50% chance you were going
to. I was like 1-1. Yeah. I saw them bad. I saw them good. And then the reunion stuff was really fun. Were,
yeah.
But it was just so invigorating and charming to see him do such a great show.
Yeah.
Like he was thirsting for the attention. He wanted people to love him. And like that, you know, and it was great. Like in the grand scheme of things, that's so long ago. And then, like the bad stuff was so long ago. And I know there's been books written about how Paul was not the greatest guy and all that, but like, it's really weird to think about, like, for the bulk of the Replacements' career, they're great.
Yes.
Oh. There's only like a really short window where they were dysfunctional because like before they played the shitty shows like we saw, they were like drunk scallywags. And I don't think it was complaining. So it's like a narrow window of just like, oh, this is bad.
Yeah.
So I think something about him woke up and said,
oh,
I can't
for sure.
keep doing this.
All right. Okay. I do have to run now. Thanks, Tom. This was great. It's going to be really good.
So.
All right. So I would love to hear people's college music stories. So you can call, you can leave a message 612-440-1984, or you can email rock@suburbspod.com, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram @suburbspod. All right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan, and with me has been
Tom Nord.
We'll talk to you all tomorrow. We'll be right back.
Is that your dog? I keep hearing, is that in my house? Is there an animal in my house?
It's our dog. He's a freak.
So weird. It sounds like the dog is behind me. It's crazy.
He's behind me.
I saw a mouse last night. That's the closest thing I have to a pet.
Oh, you might actually be able to make that your pet.
No, it's too fast. I can't catch it.
Oh, you can't?
Oh. You ever seen a mouse? They're very fast. They just
leave out some cheese.
No. Jeez, I'm not giving that mouse my cheese. I earned that cheese. That's my cheese.